The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show, the home of geek folklore and paranormal entertainment, with me, Charles Christian, as once again we delve into the worlds of weirdness, urban myths, obscure histories, geek culture, ghosts, magic, witchcraft, the occult, and anything else I think will intrigue you. We start with an internet meme I stumbled across the other day. This says that the song that was number one in the music charts on your 21st birthday is how your year 2021, that's this year, is going to play out. So hard luck if anybody's got Eve of Destruction. Anyway, I googled the charts and the number one on my 21st birthday was a song called Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep by a band called Middle of the Road. Now best remembered for the fact their lead vocalist Sally Carr wore very short hot pants. I also checked out the US Billboard charts for that date, and the number one there was Carole King with It's Too Late, which is a decidedly downer tune, so I do hope that's not going to be my outlook for 2021. Just call me Mr. Chirpy Chirpy. Now, last week, we looked at some Star Wars trivia, which seemed to go down well with listeners. So this week we are looking at some Fawlty Towers trivia. Yes, five things you didn't know about the legendary British TV sitcom starring John Cleese, which first aired in 1975. First of our little trivia points is that although it was set in Torquay, which is a south coast seaside resort in England, most of the location filming actually took place in Harrow and Wembley, with restaurants, hospitals doubling for Devon. And the scene where Basil maniacally attacks his car with a branch was shot in a suburban London street. As for the building used as the hotel exterior, that was actually a golf club in Buckinghamshire called the Woburn Grange Country Club. However, it burned down in 1991 and the ruins were demolished soon after. Houses now stand on its previous site, so I'm afraid you can't go there and see the scene of where Fawlty Towers was shot. Second thing you probably didn't realise, and it's quite surprising, in fact almost appalling, for writing, filming and performing the first series of Fawlty Towers, John Cleese was paid £6,000 for 43 weeks' work. He was only able to spend so much time on the show because he supplemented his income by appearing in television advertisements during the same time. Point number three. BBC owns the words Fawlty Towers as a trademark under several classes which cover all sorts of things, including computer games, calendars, clothing, accommodation services, catering services, hotels, restaurants, cafe and bar services. So should you ever be minded, you cannot open up a hotel and call it Fawlty Towers. Well, you can if you pay a licence fee to the BBC. Now, one thing that's always puzzled people is why, given it was such a successful show, why did it only go through two series and in fact only had six episodes in both series? So you're looking at just 12 episodes altogether. Well, and out that John Cleese and his then wife Connie Booth, who co-wrote the script and also co-starred in it, were having a difficulty in their marriage, and indeed Fawlty Towers was the only thing that was keeping them together. After the second series was released in 1979, the couple went through a divorce, although they did keep it private for some time. The BBC then offered them lots of money, presumably more than £6,000, for a third series, but they decided that the spark had gone, as had their relationship, and they feared that if they wrote a third series, they wouldn't be able to do it as anything as good as the first two series. So they decided not to go any further. And finally, each episode of Fawlty Towers begins with the hotel sign being rearranged to spell comical phrases. It's one of those signs where the letters can be moved around. So you get somewhere it says, not Fawlty Towers, but Farty Towels or Fatty Owls or Watery Fowls. There was actually a production assistant called Ian McLean, who was also a crossword puzzle fanatic, and he came up with a list of anagrams for the show. One particular notorious show, the fifth episode in the second series, the words were rearranged to say flowery t-s. The use of the obscene word caused the show to be given a 12-age certificate by the BBFC, who look after show categorisations. So it's the only episode in the series to have a more restrictive rating than PG parental guidance. So that's five things you didn't know about Fawlty Towers. And we've got Janie back with us for a little item, which I'm calling When Vegetables Attack. Although it's actually very serious in point. And it all started, we grew potatoes last year, and I, in my innocence, thought that green potatoes were merely potatoes that weren't ripe. And if I left them long enough, they'd all become okay. But Janie tells me this is not the case.
No. And in fact, it's the opposite of the case. But you were nearly right, yeah. No, it's an easy mistake to make, obviously, and I realised how it actually happens as well, because, of course, that's why you have to bank up potatoes when you grow them. This is all a bit of extra information that nobody wants to know. You have to bank up the soil around the base of them so no sunlight can get on them, because that's actually what makes them go green. So there, completely opposite.
Oh.
But yes, danger lurking in the larder.
Ooh.
And there's quite a few things that could kill us. Well, there's quite a lot of things edible, potentially, yes, that could kill us. But we all know about mushrooms, so that's not a...
And we also think about things like meat going off and canned tins that have got punctured and... listeria and salmonella and eggs and things, but we're looking at vegetables, aren't we?
Well, yes, and it's amazing that we eat certain vegetables which do have toxic parts of them, or in some quantities are toxic, and we gaily eat them and never give it a moment's thought. So let's kick off with potatoes, as you say. They are part of the nightshade family, as in deadly nightshade, so I suppose that gives us a bit of a clue.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other vegetables that are in the nightshade family, certainly tomatoes, eggplants would be another one, or aubergines, as they're called. There are others. And what it is in potatoes, it's a chemical, solanine, I think that's how you pronounce it, which is a toxic glycoalkyd, just for anybody that wants to know detail. And it's when they're green, it indicates that there's high levels of the toxin. And apparently it's concentrated most just below the skin. So obviously you'd peel them anyway, but it's probably a good idea to avoid them completely. Or certainly not to eat them in any quantity. And I think they might be even a bit bitter if they are green, which would also give you a clue.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a tragic case not that long ago. It was in Russia. And a young girl was unbelievably orphaned by her whole family after a gas that they give off that is related to this toxic chemical, basically killed her family. And how it happened was just awful. They grew their own potatoes. I imagine they were their own potatoes. And they stored them in their cellar, which no doubt they kept nice and dark and kept the door closed, which you would do because keeping them cool is part of the storage thing, as I discovered.
And keeping them dark as well.
And keeping them dark, yes, yep. Again, I had to find all that out last year when we tried to go a bit of preppers and have our own little garden. But, yeah. And the way it happened, just absolutely awful. I think originally the father went down and presumably to check the potatoes or to get some of the potatoes, opened the cellar door, walked down the cellar steps, and the gas coming off all these somewhat rotten potatoes, but I mean, they're not really rotten, they're just doing what potatoes do, going green, producing the toxic gas. Apparently, he literally became unconscious, which is how you actually do react to this gas. And if you eat them, actually, you're more likely to have irritated gastric tract or feel a bit sick. Mm-hmm. But this was a gas coming off, and he died. And obviously didn't come back, so the mother of the family decided to go look for him. She opened the door, walked down the steps, obviously got towards the bottom and was overcome by the fumes as well and died very soon afterwards. And then the couple's 18-year-old son went in search of his parents, only to suffer the same fate as the mother and the father, inhaled the toxic, highly toxic fumes. And basically, he passed away too. There was actually a grandmother called up a neighbour apparently to say something suspicious was going on, to plead for help. But before the help came, she also went into the cellar, as you would. You were kind of...
Where's my family?
Where's the family? Collapsed and died like the others.
Yes.
And then, in fact, this little girl, Maria, who was 8 years old at the time, she naturally decided to go and find out where all the family had disappeared to. But this time she left the door open.
The grandmother, I think,
had left the grandmother door. Had left the door open, that's right. And so an element of it had dispersed, and she did manage to
survive.
And yeah, she is now being cared for by other relatives. And that was in the Russian Republic of Tatarstan on the Volga River. It's kind of serious.
Yeah,
that we pay attention to these toxicities that are in plants that we happily scoff in large
now,
quantities.
I mean, some of them naturally have things unpleasant about them, like red kidney beans that you use in chilies and things.
Yes.
You've got to soak them to get the toxicity or whatever it is out of the skins.
Yes, well, I haven't researched this, but I have this in my head that it's actually that the inner structure of the beans are like little Velcro hooks. Now, am I making this all up or have I dreamt it? Somebody would probably let us know. But basically, you soak them so that these little hooks become softened, because otherwise, you obviously eat them, chew them up, it all goes into your stomach, and the actual structure of the beans causes the problem.
Yeah.
Or it may be a toxin. Really, I should have researched it, shouldn't I? But I didn't know you were going to mention that.
And I just
threw beans at me.
There's beans at you. And there's one of those African root vegetables.
There's definitely one of those. Now, is it cassava?
I think it's cassava.
Something like that,
That again has to be treated.
Gosh, that's really deadly, isn't it?
Boiled and prepared. And as long as it's prepared correctly, then there's no... Yep. problem with it.
Mm.
But now we're moving on to a couple of vegetable products, which it's not that they contain poisons as so much that the way they've been grown in some instances has caused them to become toxic by soaking up stuff in the earth.
Well, indeed, yes. As if it wasn't bad enough that stuff contains it, we also seem to be subject to the environment that they're grown in. And that can also be fatal. And obviously, it's fairly in the news lately, but some people might not have heard about, obviously, the issue of salads and being infected with E. coli. I'm not sure if this is just in America where there are massive feedlots, and that's cattle feedlots, where they're, I presume, taken to finish before they're taken off to the abattoir,
yes.
That there's a link there. But E. coli can be found just in water. So essentially what's happened is that it specifically seems to be related to romaine lettuce, as in
yes.
R-O-M-A-I-N-E.
Yep.
And it's a situation where some people have died. I think about half a dozen people have died, but they've had several hundred people be very sick with it, and quite a few hundred more to be marginally sick with it. It's you know, diarrhea, fever, abdominal cramps, nausea, vomiting, and in some cases a form of kidney failure. And initially, it was thought that all these E. coli infections were related to undercooked beef, for instance. And then there was a deadly outbreak linked to baby spinach, which started to make people think, oh, was it something to do with contaminated greens? So it was all sourced back, the outbreak was sourced back to a spinach field, who apparently was leased to a rancher who grazed cattle on the rest of the property. And the actual strain of the E. coli implicated in the outbreak also turned up in the water and the manure on the ranch. So it's thought what's happening is that where you have cattle, there can be spread, but they're not 100% sure how. Could be water, could be air, could be manure going through the soil. There was one quote I saw in a piece about it. This was by Richard Raymond, who was an undersecretary for the US Department of Agriculture. Whenever you have an E. coli outbreak, he says, in any produce, and you do a long enough investigation, eventually you will bump into a cow. And I think that's just perhaps more to do with the fact of how they're grazed in the open or in feedlots in the open, and then lettuce is grown nearby.
Sort of runoff from
the
slurry.
I still don't really know quite why, but I think it probably hasn't really helped the sale of
romaine
lettuce, which is a shame because I love it.
Yes.
And in fact, I do still buy it.
You do?
Yeah.
We live dangerously.
Yeah. I give it a good old wash, naturally. But, yeah, so that's your lettuce.
That's your lettuce. And then
that
we've
got...
That
goes with your potatoes if you're having a salad. So that's out.
That's
so you've got no potatoes in your salad and you've got no lettuce.
Right.
But don't think of replacing that with rice.
Oh.
No. I'm sad to say. Another cause for worry is arsenic in rice, which, again, many people might not know. It's obviously, arsenic is not nice.
No.
It's not something we should really eat too much of. It's a metal element, actually. And it's naturally prevalent in air and soil and water. But it's absorbed by some food crops as they grow. It's not added to rice. Mm. It's a natural thing.
Yes.
And yeah, it turns out that rice is a particularly, how can I put it, susceptible grain to soak up large quantities of arsenic. But it does vary with where it's grown and the type of rice. And
because I believe basmati rice is less.
Well, that's all I've heard.
Yes.
All right. I've just, you know, done the usual, have a Google. And I have no idea why that might be so.
Mm.
But I have heard for some reasons that it's grown slightly differently, yeah. maybe. Or maybe it just doesn't absorb so much. Not really sure.
Mm. And it's really the way rice is grown in paddy fields in water, isn't it?
That well, that's how it's normally grown. So, I mean, is it cause or effect? It's like that's how it's yes. normally grown. So is it that it is grown in water?
So if there's arsenic in the water,
yeah.
Then they are, plants are soaked in it and they're going to absorb. Yeah.
Well, we're kind of hypothesising there, are really, indeed. Aren't yes, we? And yes. we don't know. We don't really know that much about it. Only what we kind of research and read, but... it's one of those things that you must... Well, from the research I did, obviously, so people want to know, well, what are we supposed to do? Well, basically, I think not feed too much rice-based product to babies seems quite a good idea
mm-hmm.
because many baby foods do tend to have a lot of rice in because presumably it's easily digestible.
Yeah.
And so if you imagine per kilogram of the person, they might be getting a relatively large amount of rice. So that's...
that makes sense.
Makes great sense, doesn't it? But also, I think, because arsenic can be found in other grains as well, but not to such a high extent as I understand it, is to make sure you vary your grains. Don't just eat all rice, if you can... avoid it, of course, because that would add the number of milligrams per kilogram that you weigh. Add that up and you'll be taking more than you should. So I suppose, dietary exposure means dietary variety will help you with that one. But I don't think there's an awful lot you can do regarding it. It's just a grain that, as I say, does tend to have a lot in it. Maximum concentration of arsenic has been found in rice bran. And because of this, rice milks can have a higher concentration, allegedly.
And I believe you shouldn't feed babies and young children rice milk as a substitute for mother's milk.
No, that's totally right. How on earth do you know that? But that is true. Yeah, apparently. Yes, so that's rice and arsenic. And, I mean, you can go into a huge amount of detail about it, but it's just one of those things that you think, what could be more harmless than a big bowl of white rice? It looks completely innocuous, doesn't it?
But,
scoffing it at every opportunity. Rammed down with some lettuce and a potato.
Is bad for you.
It's not. No. Probably better just to eat cake.
Eat cake.
But not rice cakes.
Not rice cake.
They're quite bad for you, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly.
We like them.
Well, we did. We like them with chocolate on top.
Yes.
So that's all I have at the moment on when vegetables go bad.
Right. Talking of going bad, I can hear our dog going bad and barking downstairs. So.
I will go and deal with the pack of dog. Hounds.
Ain't taking. OK then, Janie, that was great. Thank you ever so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye now.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
I was leafing through my files looking for events to commemorate on this day in history and came across this one, May the 10th, 1941. So almost exactly 80 years ago. On this day, Adolf Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, mysteriously parachuted into Scotland on the intention to negotiate a secret peace deal with the British. And he apparently did this without any knowledge of the Führer, that's Adolf Hitler, who was apparently livid when he heard the news. Hess had met with a English aristocrat called the Duke of Hamilton at the Berlin Olympics in 1936 and came to the conclusion that the Duke was a member of a far-right group who were interested in a German-English agreement, and therefore he hoped Hamilton, the Duke of Hamilton, would arrange for him to meet King George VI, the then King of England, believing that the King could be persuaded to sack Winston Churchill, who was then the Prime Minister of Britain, so Britain could make peace with Germany and join forces against the Soviet Union. So at 6,000 feet and within 30 miles of the Duke's residence near Glasgow, Hess bailed out of the Messerschmitt that he'd been piloting by himself and parachuted safely to ground. His first contact was with a Scottish farmer who he told, "I have an important message for the Duke of Hamilton." Interrogated at army barracks, he proposed that the British should allow Germany to dominate Europe, in return for which the British Empire would be safe from attack by Adolf Hitler. He insisted, this is Hess, that Germany would win the war, and said that the British people would starve to death by blockade unless they accepted his generous offer. Hitler quickly issued a statement saying that his deputy was mentally disordered and a victim of hallucinations. He was immediately stripped of all ranks that he held in the Nazi Party, including being a party member, and Hitler made secret orders that Hess should be shot on sight if he ever returned to Germany. So who was Hess? Well, he was born actually in Egypt in 1894, the son of a Bavarian wholesaler. And when the First World War broke out in 1914, he served with the Bavarian Field Artillery, was wounded several times and won an Iron Cross. Sharing Hitler's view that Germany had been stabbed in the back in their failure to win the 1914-18 war, and it was caused by a conspiracy of the Jews and Bolsheviks rather than military defeat, Hess joined the Nazi Party in 1920 and quickly became Hitler's friend and confidant. He was at Hitler's side in November 1923 for the Beer Hall Putsch, a failed attempt by the Nazis to seize control of the government of Bavaria. And while the two of them were serving time in jail for this attempted coup, Hess helped Hitler write his book Mein Kampf, which became the foundation for the Nazis' political platform. After the Nazis came to power in 1933, Hess was appointed Deputy Führer, and as well as appearing on Hitler's behalf at speaking engagements and rallies, he signed into law much of the legislation that stripped German Jews of their rights. So, back to 1941. Hess's peace proposals met with no response from the British government, and he was held in prison until the end of the war. There were various examinations made of him, and it's thought, yes, he was suffering from mental delusions, but not insane. As a result, in 1946, he was sent to trial at Nuremberg, and while he was acquitted on charges related to war crimes and crimes against humanity, he was convicted of crimes against peace. In his final speech to the judges, he continued to display loyalty to Hitler, declaring, "If it was granted for me for many years to live and work under the greatest son whom my nation has brought forth in 1,000 years of its history, even if I could, I would not expunge this period from my existence. I regret nothing. If I were standing once more at the beginning, I should act once again as I did then, even if I knew that at the end I should be burned at the stake." In fact, he wasn't burned at the stake. He wasn't even hanged, as happened to most of the senior Nazi prisoners. Instead, he was sentenced to life imprisonment with a number of other lesser Nazi leaders and sent to Spandau prison in Berlin. By 1966, he was the only prisoner still left in the jail. His number was prisoner number 7, which I suppose is slightly ominous. That's the prisoner's number, isn't it? I'm not a number, I am a man. Anyway, he was denied parole, and in 1987, so by then he'd had another 21 years in prison, and at the age of 93, he hanged himself in the grounds of the jail. So that's basically the story of Rudolf Hess, and celebrating the fact it's 80 years since he began his strange venture to frighten Britain. But it does raise a number of interesting questions. The first is, of course, how did Hess, the second most important man in Nazi Germany, get to be able to commandeer an aeroplane and fly it off on his own with nobody stopping him? I mean, it's like as if the Vice President of the United States headed off to a military base, commandeered a jet fighter and flew off into the sunset and nobody said anything about it. Was it really, as Hitler tried to make out, it was just a venture on his own? Or was he doing it to sound out what the prospects for peace? Because at this time, when he flew over it in 1941, it was just before the Nazis were about to launch their attack on Russia. And of course, having Britain on their side, or at least no longer fighting, would have certainly made life a little simpler for the Nazis if they were fighting only on one front. I say, it's very strange that. And then there's the question of his death. He'd been pretty much a solitary prisoner. Well, obviously, there were guards there, but he'd been in isolation for 21 years. And at the age of 93, he then hanged himself. There was a summer house in the prison garden that was a reading room, and he apparently used the extension cord from one of the table lamps and hanged himself with that. There was a note in his pocket thanking them for all they had done, and the four powers who controlled the prison, that's the USSR as it then was still, France and Great Britain, issued a statement saying that death was by suicide. However, there is some confusion about it. Certainly, Hess was of the opinion that the British Secret Service was trying to kill him, and for a long time he was suspicious of the food he was being fed and would swap it with his guards and would keep the food as evidence in containers to prove that it was people trying to poison him. The other point was the note that was found on his body actually appeared to have been written when Hess was hospitalised as long ago as 1969, so nearly 20 years earlier. Certainly his family are very much of the opinion that he was murdered and still are unhappy with the verdict of suicide. There's also a myth that the Spandau prisoner was not actually Hess, but somebody else who was a stand-in, that the real Hess had escaped or been wafted away. However, a DNA test undertaken by a Sherman McCall, former of the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and Jan Kemper-Kieslich of the University of Salzburg, demonstrated a 99.99% match between the prisoner's Y chromosome DNA markers and those of a living male Hess relative. So, 80 years ago, and still questions marks over the myth of Rudolf Hess. Why did he fly over here? Was it solely on his own volition, or was it part of a larger plot by the Nazis that they then disavowed? And was he murdered or did he commit suicide? Sadly, we'll never know. Here's a bit of seasonal folklore. For the 13th of May is known as Old May Day. This is people still banging on about the fact that in the middle of the 18th century we moved from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, and we lost a number of days and the calendar was adjusted. Anyway, this particular time we are looking at cowslips, type of flower, and it was a time when country girls would turn to the humble cowslip for a game and marriage divination. We've got a report here from a Molly Harris who talks about doing this in the 1920s. So it is 100 years on since she was reported having done this. And she says, when spring had really come and the warm sun had brought out more meadow flowers, we would pick baskets of cowslips so that our mother might make some homemade wine. We used to keep some of the best blooms to ourselves and make what we called a titsy-tosty ball. Yes, titsy-tosty ball. We'd take off the main stalk and bunch up the thick flower heads together, tying them in the middle with wool and making a soft, sweet-smelling ball. Then, for hours, we would play a game called Tell Me True, with each girl tossing a ball in the air, keeping in time with this jingle. Tisty tosty, tell me true, who shall I be married to? Tisty tosty, cowslip ball, at my sweetheart's name, you'll fall. So basically, the girls are playing sort of a keepy-uppy, except where instead of kicking a football, they're tossing this flower ball up and down in the air. And after they'd said the rhyme, they would then name their favourite boys. These would be boys they were at school with or knew in the village or whatever, boys they fancied. So they'd be tossing the ball in the air and saying, Percy, Charlie, Jimmy, Tom, Billy, Frankie, Bob, Bert, whatever. And when they failed to catch the ball and it fell to the ground, whoever's name was mentioned was the boy they were going to marry. Now, you can obviously see there's a fairly fundamental error in this, in that it's very easy for you, if you're doing this, to not catch the ball when the boy you really fancy's name's mentioned. Anyway, as we've said before in these in this show, when it comes to the activities of country girls in bygone times, you have to remember, they had no television, they had no social media, they had no radio, they had no cinema. They had to make their own entertainment. Anyway, cowslips, another form of marriage divination. Now, earlier in the show, Janie was talking about the fact that rice can contain arsenic, which is one of the classic poisons that are used in crime. One of the other ones is, of course, strychnine. And strychnine is the poison of choice of the next character we're looking at in our ongoing series of Doctors Who Kill. And the subject of this one is Dr. Thomas Neil Cream, otherwise known as the Lambeth Poisoner. Now, with most killings, there's sometimes it's possible to have some sympathy for the murderer, maybe only a little bit of sympathy, but in the case of Neil Cream, absolutely none. Most of his killings were for no motive other than to satisfy some perverse whim of his own. As to the poison he employed, although more efficient ones were available, he preferred strychnine as it meant his victims suffered lingering painful deaths. The story began in the 1850s when his family left Glasgow and emigrated to Canada. After going to school there, he went on to read medicine at McGill University. Then, in 1878, he returned to Scotland and obtained what was described as the double qualifications of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons at Edinburgh. With these solid qualifications behind him, he once more crossed the Atlantic and opened up a medical practice, first in Ontario and later in Chicago. Illegal abortions appear to have been his forte. Unfortunately, many of his patients died during their treatment, with the result that his reputation became increasingly unsavoury. Things went from bad to worse, and in 1881, Neil Cream used strychnine to murder a man named Stott, the husband of his current mistress. Unbelievably, although foul play was not at first suspected, Cream actually wrote to the local district attorney and demanded that Stott's body be exhumed. This was done, and the subsequent post-mortem revealed strychnine. As a result of his exhibitionist behaviour, Cream was arrested, tried, and eventually sentenced to life imprisonment. But that was not the end of the story. Cream was released from prison in July 1891 after serving just about 10 years of his sentence, and in October that year he landed in England, undeterred by his previous experiences, and resumed his career. Within a few days, a mysterious Dr. Thomas Neal was installed in lodgings in a seedy area of London's Lambeth, south of the river, and was purchasing large quantities of Nux Vomica, the principal source of strychnine. In the weeks that followed, three prostitutes, Ellen Donworth, Emma Shrivell, and Alice Marsh, were all found either dead or dying from strychnine poisoning in the Lambeth area. The only clue the police had came from the dying words of Ellen Donworth. She said that a man called Fred, a tall gentleman with cross eyes, a silk hat and bushy whiskers, had given her something to drink out of a bottle. The description matched that of Cream, it should be noted. The cross eyes and the bushy beard. The breakthrough came in April 1892, when the police received an anonymous letter stating that Walter Harper, a doctor at St. Thomas's Hospital in Lambeth, did for Marsh and for Shrivell what he also did for Clover and Lou Harvey. Subsequent investigations revealed that the Clover reference was to a woman called Matilda Clover, another local prostitute who had been found dead a few months previously. Her body was exhumed and a post-mortem revealed hitherto undiscovered strychnine. The police had no idea what had become of Lou Harvey, but they were certain that the letter's anonymous author was the murderer. As a matter of routine, the police interviewed the much maligned Dr. Harper, and although they drew a blank with him, their suspicions were aroused by one of his fellow lodgers, the mysterious Dr. Neal. The police started to follow his movements, and in June they discovered that he was attempting to blackmail Dr. Joseph Harper, that's Walter Harper's father. The blackmail note proved to be in the same writing as that of the anonymous letter. So, on June 3rd, 1892, Neil Cream, alias Dr. Neal, was arrested for attempting to obtain money under false pretenses. This is from the blackmail letter. Once in custody, the evidence against him started to mount up. Two prostitutes identified him as the man they had seen with Matilda Clover shortly before her death, and who they knew as Fred. Then, at the inquest on Clover, Cream's behaviour was so bizarre that the coroner's jury had no hesitation about passing a verdict that he had poisoned her with strychnine. The biggest surprise came during subsequent committal proceedings when Louisa Harris, alias Lou Harvey, arrived at the court after reading about the case in the paper. Her story was the previous October she, when she was still working as a prostitute, had spent the night with Cream. Later he had given her some pills to clear up some facial spots, but being suspicious, she had not taken them. This story, coinciding with Ellen Donworth's final words, plus evidence to the fact Cream had purchased 1,016 of a grain strychnine pills from a drug company and had 7 bottles of strychnine solution stored at his lodgings, proved to be the damning evidence that sealed his fate. It took the jury just 12 minutes to find him guilty of murder. Neil Cream was hanged on November the 15th, 1892. However, unlike other murderers, he did not confess to the crimes he had committed. Instead, exhibitionist to the end, his final words are, "I am Jack the Ripper." However, like many of Cream's other remarks, this was also implausible, as at the time of the Ripper murders, which largely took place in 1888, between the end of August and the 9th of November, when the 5 canonical murders took place, Cream had been serving his jail sentence in Chicago for the Stott killing. We recently received a request asking that the next time we carried a magic spell, could we make it a cheery one? Hopefully this one, the self-love spell, no sniggering at the back, not that sort of self-love, will fit the bill. And it has the added attraction of being traditionally associated with the early part of May. The premise is that if you are a witch or a sorcerer, you're never going to be able to help other people be happy if you're unhappy with your own lives. So the idea is this spell will help you take a self-inventory of yourselves and work towards a personal transformation. Now, you need a pen, a paper and a 7-day candle. 7-day candles are sometimes also called memorial candles and they come in a glass jar. You can find them on Amazon. Light the candle and then on a piece of paper write down 7 things people like about you. These may be personality traits or even physical attributes. Then turn the paper over and on the reverse side, write down your 7 qualities or habits that need improving. Come on, be honest. Unless you're a narcissist, we've all got things we could improve. Place the candle somewhere safe so it can be left burning for 7 days and read out aloud the positive list. Then place the paper beneath the candle. The next day, turn the paper over and read out the negative list. Then, on the 3rd day, switch back to the positive list, read that out, and so on, continuing this process every day for a total of 7 days or until the candle burns out completely. The idea being that it'll remind yourself of your goals each day. On the final day, just before you either snuff out the candle or before you discard the burned out candle stub, say these words. In these flames I see all that I am, all that I have been, and all that I can be. So mote it be. Now here's a blast from the past. It's a murder story, and a death story, and a ghost story. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because we've just had a message from Mandy Sharp, who has read the story about the story we have on our website about Sir Walter Calverley and said, "I live in the near area and many people still hear the galloping hooves. He's still there." So what's the story? Well, Walter Calverley was a ne'er-do-well squire. Everybody called him Sir Walter, but actually he was merely Squire Calverley. And he got into all kinds of problems with leaving Cambridge University without a degree, running up huge amounts of debt, breaking off engagements and upsetting neighbours, and generally causing all manner of chaos. Anyway, at some point, he appears to have what we now recognise would have been a nervous breakdown. This was on the 23rd of April, 1605. It has to be said there was a tendency for mental ill health in the family. His father was once described as having weakness of wit and brain and being long time subject to lunacy. Anyway, on this particular day, Sir Walter accused his wife of being unfaithful to him and claimed that the children were fathered by a lover. There's absolutely no evidence to prove any of this. And he promptly stabbed to death his two oldest sons, threw the children's nurse down the stairs, killing her in the process, and tried to murder his wife. Fortunately for her, she was wearing a corset reinforced with metal stays, which deflected the dagger blow. Nevertheless, she fainted, and her husband, believing her dead, ran out of the hall and rode off in the night, intending to kill his third son, who was in the nearby village being wet-nursed, which is what they did in those days. Unfortunately for Walter, but fortunately for his son Henry, his horse stepped in a rabbit hole and fell on him, pinning him down until the authorities, alerted by the servants back at the hall where he lived, came, this is Calverley Old Hall, they came chasing after him and captured him and arrested him. This seems to have jolted Walter back to his senses. He knew there'd be no judicial forgiveness for his crime, and it would actually be several hundred years before any court would accept the plea of temporary insanity. And more importantly, he also knew that regardless of whether he pleaded guilty or not guilty, when he was convicted, as he inevitably would be, the courts of the day would confiscate his property, with the result that his wife and his remaining son would be penniless and the hall would be lost to the family forever. Walter therefore took the only remaining option open to him, and he refused to enter any plea at all. But by denying the court the right to try him, he was guilty of contempt of court, which in those days was punishable by pan forte dure, also known as pressing. This was a form of torture in which a stout door or planks of wood were laid across the victim, on top of which were piled more and more heavy stones, until eventually the hapless victim either entered a plea or was crushed to death. Despite attempts by his friends and even his long-suffering wife to have his sentence mitigated, Walter Calverley was pressed to death at York Castle on the 5th of August, 1605. He never entered a plea, and according to some reports, his last words were, and this would be said in a Yorkshire accent, "A pund more weight." That's a Scottish accent, sorry. "A pund more weight. Lig on, lig on." Which is basically, add on more weight, lay it on, lay it on. Sir Walter was buried in York, possibly in a rather thin but large coffin, and it was then exhumed and moved to the family plot at St Wilfrid's Church in Calverley, where it lays beside his murdered sons. There is a sort of a happy ending because he hadn't entered a plea. His estates and property were not confiscated by the state, so his wife, who subsequently remarried, stayed in the hall, and his son eventually inherited the hall. And that was the story of Sir Walter Calverley, except there's a ghost story. And it's said that the ghost of Walter Calverley, brandishing a bloodstained dagger in one hand, has often been seen galloping around the area around Calverley and St. Wilfrid's churchyard, galloping around on a large black horse. The black horse, needless to say, has glaring red eyes. Sometimes the ghost disappears at the point where the horse fell. At other times, with the ghost shouting, "Lig on, lig on," it rushes at any witnesses and vanishes just as it reaches them. And finally, there's a story, first reported as long ago as the 1830s, of schoolboys who regularly tried to raise Calverley's ghost on evenings after class. Piling their hats and caps together in a pyramid, they would form a magic circle and hand in hand would dance around the churchyard singing, old Calverley, I have thee by the ears, I'll cut thee into collops unless thee appears." Collops, I should hasten to add, is an old name for slices of meat or bacon. The ritual required them to mix pins and breadcrumbs together and scatter them in front of the church. after which one of them would walk up to the church door and whistle through the keyhole to summon Walter's ghost. A newspaper report from 1874 says that on one occasion the ritual worked, causing the boys to run away in terror, as it would. When they returned the following morning, their hats and capes had vanished forever, presumably taken by the ghost of Sir Walter. So that was the background. And as I say, Mandy Sharp, thank you very much for getting in touch. She has been in touch to say that Sir Walter's ghost is still haunting the area. A commentator by the name of RJ has also been in touch to say he almost caught pneumonia hanging around in the graveyard looking for Sir Walter's ghost in the 1980s. He says, we did see something odd that night, but whether this was just teenage hysteria or Sir Walter, I've never been sure. And we also have a Lindsay Bancroft who was in touch to say she just found out that Walter Calverley is one of her ancestors and is going off to Calverley to look at the site. So, the saga of Walter Calverley and his ghost that in 2021 apparently is still active. And that's it. We're out of time again. We're ending on a motivational message by the legendary folk singer Judy Collins. This was quoted in a recent Guardian newspaper profile. In it, Judy says, talking about the fact she was an alcoholic, I drank for 23 years, and in that time I was able to forge a career that, like the Energizer Bunny, has gone on to this day. I didn't do many drugs. I always thought they interfered with my drinking. Food for thought there. Now it just remains for me to say this is Charles Christian saying thank you for listening in. Please join me again next week for more weird tales in weird times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.